You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, April 29th, 2020, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
Hi.
Another week of lockdown and pandemic, and we're coasting along. I think we're coasting along. So, a lot of nonsense going on in the past week. I want to bring up a few things. So, today, just as we're recording this, I think the thing that was blowing up the most is this video. Do you guys see this video put out by these California ER docs, Doctors Erickson and Masihi?
Yes.
Oh, I saw that was trending, but I didn't watch the video yet.
Yeah, it's trending, all right. We've got a lot of questions about it.
What's the deal?
All right, here's the deal. I'm sure they're perfectly fine emergency doctors, right? And they own apparently a chain of like walk-in emergency clinics in the area. They just opened up a couple, but business is way down because people aren't going to emergency rooms because they don't want to, get exposed to the pandemic. Bakersfield?
Oh, Bakersfield, you know California. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what did they do? Hire clowns as entertainment?
So they did this like 1 hour kind of interview style thing that then went up on YouTube. And they made a number of scientifically controversial claims that happen to play right into the right-wing talking points. You know, so now they're making the rounds on Fox News, et cetera, et cetera.
Great.
So, yeah, it's a good way to get a lot of attention is to express an opinion that goes against the mainstream, right? Because anyone could say, this is what the scientists and the experts are saying. But if you're saying something different, then that's a commodity, right?
You've been noticing that like the obvious choice is the Dr. Oz is the Dr. Phil's. Like they've been doing that a lot and going on Fox News. I've also been seeing Dr. Drew doing that a lot. And don't get me wrong. I know that Dr. Drew is like a reality show doctor. But I feel like he's historically always been very pro-evidence. And he was usually like Dr. Gupta. Like he was speaking on more, I guess you could say left-wing or you could say more neutral outlets, depending. But I've been kind of surprised to see him on Fox News a lot lately too.
Well, he completely spoiled himself, right? Because he said a bunch of ridiculous things and it was like, you know, not following the standard and accepted information about COVID-19.
Oh, so that's really what it is.
There's a big market for
against the mainstream
for doctors and people who could be put forward as experts saying stupid things. Big market for that these days. Yeah. All right.
Gotcha. Okay.
So here's the thing. These guys here, what their main point is that they said a lot of dumb things, but their main point was that the pandemic is not as bad as everyone is saying it is, and that they think that we should open up, you know, get rid of the lockdown and open up the economy, right?
Oh, well, that's the talking point. Yeah, of course.
That's the talking point. Yeah, that some people want. So, but here's how they get to that conclusion. And it's nice that they're objectively and profoundly wrong, and it's not just a matter of interpretation or opinion. You know what I mean? Because it makes the narrative a lot cleaner that what they said was blatantly dumb. So let me tell you what they said. So they had access apparently to a lot of tests, and they've been running testing for COVID-19 out of their ERs, out of their emergency clinics. And they said they published a quote-unquote study, which is really just data from their testing. And they said that out of the tests they did, in the Bakersfield area, 12% of the tests were positive. Therefore, they concluded from that, and somebody tell me, not you, Kara, somebody who's not a medical expert, tell me what's wrong with this conclusion. Because 12% of the people they tested were positive for COVID-19, they extrapolated that to the conclusion that 12% of Californians have COVID-19.
My God. I mean, they went to be tested because they probably thought they needed to be tested because they had symptoms.
Right.
Right? That's what. So, of course, it's going to be skewed upwards like crazy.
Yeah.
Not
a random sample. So what's a good technical term for that? So it's not a representative sample.
Right.
Or you could say that there's selection bias because that's the opposite of having a randomized or a representative sample is a selected or a selected biased sample. And in fact, they themselves previously, when they were sort of advertising the fact that they have testing, said, we're only going to test people who are symptomatic. So right there, they're saying that they're
surprised it wasn't higher.
Yeah, they're only testing people who are symptomatic. David Gorski on Respectful Insulin did a great takedown of it. It was so good. It's like, I don't have to write about it myself because that's pretty much
he said. I'm sure it was thorough as well.
It was good. Yeah, yeah. And he said, that's like concluding, oh, 5% of the people in the emergency room have broken legs. Therefore, 5% of the population have broken legs.
God. Yeah, that's a good one.
So, yeah, so that's like charitably, you could call that a quote unquote rookie mistake. But even like you guys aren't, you know, the non-medical people on this panel are not even rookie doctors. You're just lay people who have a passing understanding of things like statistics and research methodology. This is sort of like any first year medical student should be able to
it's
answer
obvious.
This question. Why? Yeah, it's pretty obvious if you have any know anything about scientific studies. So that's the core of their big claim was that ridiculously naive, assumption about that they're sampling.
Do you really think it's naive, or do you think that they do know?
It's motivated. It's motivated reasoning. Yeah, so it's always you know that carrot. It's always a combination, right? You can sort of convince yourself with the motivated reasoning, and you
especially
don't really
when a
think
bunch of
carefully
like,
about it.
Pundits on TV are like, "Ooh, come on our show! Come on our show!"
Right?
Yep.
Right.
Probably fits in with their worldview too.
That's
could
correct,
do,
Evan. That's a good assumption. Yeah. You shouldn't make assumptions, but that turns out to be a correct assumption in this part.
Hey.
Dr. Masihi, in at least prior to all of this, you know, has also published videos and stuff, you know, praising Trump and clearly being pretty much at the far right end of the political spectrum. So, yeah, this you know fits their current economic interests, their political ideology. They're not experts. They're not epidemiologists. They're not virologists. And what they're saying is objectively and blatantly wrong. But they're doctors, you know, and they're saying things that some people want to hear. And so that's it. They're making the rounds. And so this is unfortunately what we're seeing here. We actually had a question. I was going to do it in the question and answer section, but it dovetails nicely with this. The question's about, you know, quote unquote, following the science, like everyone claims, oh, we're following the science. But following the science is not objective. It's, well, how are you, quote unquote, following the science? Are you cherry picking the people you want to, you know, you want to follow or the scientific results that you want to follow? Are you, how are you interpreting it? How are you weighting different kinds of evidence? You know, so
controlling your own bias or at least checking your own bias.
Unfortunately,
what's good science to you?
It's complicated enough that you can superficially create the impression that you're quote unquote following the science, when in fact you're not. You're following your ideological or tribal biases, and you're just cherry picking the science that seems superficially to support that position. But it's a great way to create confusion and dilute the real science, you know, that's out there and the real experts and expertise. So these guys should be ashamed of themselves. You know, this is, there's at least a layer of shameless self-promotion in here. They are not experts, but they are lobbing their ball of confusion and misinformation into the mix. It was so bad, in fact, that they got a smackdown from their professional organization.
Good. Yeah. Well, that's who should be doing that. Definitely.
Yeah, no, sure. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. You know,
saying that this was, you know, the American College of Emergency Physicians and the American Academy of Emergency Medicine provided a scathing rebuke of comments made last week by Accelerated Urgent Care doctors Daniel Erickson and Artin Masihi. The statement in part says, as owners of local urgent care clinics, it appears these two individuals are releasing biased, non-peer-reviewed data to advance their personal financial interests without regard for the public's health. COVID-19 misinformation is widespread and dangerous. It continues, members of ASEP and AAEM are firsthand witnesses to the human toll that COVID-19 is taking on our communities. They strongly advise against using any statements of these guys as a basis for policy and decision making. So that's when you provoke a rebuke from your professional organization, that's bad.
Yeah.
That's
like
really
as bad as it gets.
That's probably like one step away from like a licensing hearing.
Mm. See, the state could potentially act against them.
Mm.
They're very reluctant to do that. States are, but they theoretically could. One other dumb thing that they said, because that wasn't the only dumb thing that they said. They said it's actually dangerous for people to be at home to the extent that they are, because it will weaken the immune system, because our immune systems are not getting a workout by being exposed to pathogens.
Right. Yeah. So that's super irresponsible.
That's wholesale made up. Those two guys just pulled that right out of their butts.
Exactly. So that provoked rebukes from epidemiologists and virologists and immunologists saying, your homes are loaded with trillions of pathogens. You are not getting, like, unless you live in an autoclave, your home is pathogen rich. So
Oh, yeah.
Do not worry about it. Your immune system is getting plenty of workout at home. So that was just silly. Just again, they're making stuff up that superficially, you know, sounds sciencey if you're not really an expert. And unfortunately, you know, this plays into the stereotype of, you know, the Dunning-Kruger with physicians and other professionals, because you're an expert in one thing, you think you're an expert in everything.
Yeah.
And that's dangerous. That's very, very dangerous. So, you know, bad on them, but it's, you know, they did a lot of damage. You know, and they're getting a lot of faith. They're getting a lot of screen time, a lot of attention, and it's very, very unfortunate.
You know, that really riles me up.
Does it?
Dalek unit reinitializing. Seek, locate, exterminate.
Oh, is that going to be a weekly thing now, Bob?
No, bi-weekly. Maybe twice a month. Twice a month.
I love it.
But always
Bob's gonna
on the live
stream. Try it weekly, everyone.
Jay loves it so much, it makes me want to do it even more.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. I'll keep it more to the live stream, Steve.
I've got more space lawyer jokes, too. So.
Oh, God.
Standing by.
I love them.
Admit Daleks are better than space lawyer jokes.
I'm siding with Evan on this one.
Wow.
Awesome.
Watch some goddamn Doctor Who, will you?
Carrie, you're lacking in education. I'm sorry.
I have seen plenty of Doctor Who episodes.
All right. Okay, that's good.
When I was in college, I dated a Doctor Who fanatic. So I've seen the old black and whites. I saw the more recent ones.
Who's your favorite doctor?
That's good.
The woman doctor?
There you go.
She's good.
She wasn't the doctor yet when I was dating.
True.
She's the current doctor. She's good. I like
her.
She's
awesome. Yeah. She's awesome. I love her.
Though David Tennant's my favorite.
Yeah, he's number one.
Yeah, at least she's not spreading misinformation about COVID-19, okay?
All right, let's get back to COVID-19 really quick.
Yes.
So let's run the numbers quickly. 3.2 million cases worldwide, 227,000 deaths worldwide. In the U.S., the numbers are still, unfortunately, going up strong. We just ticked over 60,000 deaths in the U.S.
And how many? How many confirmed cases?
Was it about 1 million?
That was a big number just this past few days. Yeah, we just ticked over a million confirmed cases.
Well, and also, aren't we changing the way that we're counting them? Like, on a daily basis, it feels like different areas within the U.S. are starting to count deaths that weren't originally.
Yes, states are.
Yeah, so, okay, so there's results. That was another thing that happened, is there was a study. Remember we talked about the study in New York City where they said that the excess deaths were a lot higher than the official COVID-19 deaths?
Yeah.
Well, that study nationwide has not been published. It was actually partly a Yale group that did that. And what they found was they looked at mainly the month of March, like up till April 4th. They found that there were 15,400 excess deaths in the U.S. from March to April 4th, but there were only 8,128 confirmed deaths from COVID-19. So it's, you know, not quite twice the number of official deaths. So that could mean that, like, if all of those excess deaths are actually COVID-19, that would mean that the death rate is actually 40% or so higher than what it is. But
right.
Here's the thing. A couple of other factors in there. One thing, however, is that there are fewer homicides and traffic accidents because of lockdown. So,
sure.
Yeah, so that means that more of the...
The number's even more inflated.
Yeah, more of those deaths are COVID-19 because you have to subtract out the fewer deaths from the lockdown itself. But what we don't know is how many of those deaths are direct versus indirect.
Right.
You know, like, is it somebody who didn't go to the emergency room and had a heart attack at home and died? Yeah, because they were afraid of the
right,
virus. Versus somebody who had the virus. And then you also don't know things like, well, what if somebody had the virus and they were going to die anyway, but they died a little bit faster because, you know, in other words, is it going to be like a dip in death later because all the people that would have been dying over the next 6 months died already from COVID-19. But anyway, from one point of view, I think the excess deaths is a very telling number. Whatever the mix in there, whether it's direct or indirect, it's still people dying prematurely because we're in the middle of a pandemic. You know what
mm-hmm.
I mean?
And the truth is, early on, when we first started to become aware, which was basically February into April, we didn't have testing. We just didn't have functional tests. So there's really no way to
still
know.
Don't have enough.
Didn't they do a study? It was in California, like Santa Clarita, where they found a, I don't know how they did it post-mortem, but they found that actually the earliest kind of proven case where they were able to test her after the fact of somebody who died of COVID-19 was actually in California, not Seattle. And so that really worried people because it was like in February.
Early February.
Yeah. And so it's like, yes, it probably wasn't like well established in the community by then, but it probably was starting to find itself in the American community before we thought it had.
One other thing I wanted to point out, because I wrote about this on Science-Based Medicine, there was a report published of a case series in a New York City health system where they had five strokes in patients with COVID-19 who were less than 55 years old. So that's a, or less than 50 years old. So it's a technically a young stroke. Normally they get 0.7 over a 2-week period. So like less than one person over 2 weeks in that age group with large vessel strokes. And in this period they had five and they all had COVID-19. So that
times eight. Like,
that could be a statistical fluke. You don't know. You know, it's five people. You know what I mean? But
definitely got a lot of airtime. Like people were freaking out over it. I mean, it could be a really interesting and worrisome thing. But
it's very plausible. So, you know, infection, a lot of infections are known to cause hypercoagulopathy, right? Meaning that your blood has an increased tendency to clot and therefore form a thrombus and then cause things like stroke, heart attack, DVT, pulmonary embolism. So,
COVID toes. Yeah, so they've been referring to it as COVID toes when their toes turn blue.
Quote unquote frostbite looking toes.
Oh, wow.
So, so mechanistically, it's very plausible. You know, viruses can do this. You know, young strokes are rare. And so you notice them. You notice even an individual young stroke and you would search more aggressively for what caused it. When you have a pulse like this of five people. And also, it's not different kinds of strokes. They were all the same kind of stroke, a large vessel thrombus. You know what I mean? So they weren't. So that suggests a common mechanism. So again, it's all circumstantial, but it's very interesting. I think my guess would be at this point that, yeah, that's probably due to COVID-19. But we need to confirm that with prospective studies, right? We need to like really look at data going forward and seeing if that correlation is genuine. And then, you know, we need to do some follow-up basic science to see like mechanistically, is this... Does it cause a hypercoagulable state, for example? Are there other types of blood clots are more at risk in patients who have COVID-19? Is it just some subpopulations, et cetera? So a lot of questions.
Yeah, is it people who might have already gotten blood clot, like gotten a blood clot, were more at risk because they had COVID or something? Like,
yeah, who knows? You know, it could be, there's lots of cofactors that may be playing a role. So a lot of questions that get raised by that. But this is... The reason I bring it up primarily is because it reminds us that this is a new disease we don't fully understand. Things like this can still come out of the data. You know, when we really start looking at a lot of patients and our clinical experience grows, we're going to start noticing things like this. This is probably an uncommon side effect of the virus because it's just, you know, so far five cases. Although the authors of the study pointed out that there's incidence of stroke in hospitalized patients with COVID-19 in China in one study was 5%, but I don't know how that compares to what would be expected over that same period of time. And large vessel stroke was reported in association with SARS-CoV-1. So again, that probably not a coincidence. So there's still a lot to learn about this disease. You know, again, this is all happening in real time. All right. So, and the other bottom line is no. It's not just a flu. This is a much more serious illness than the flu. All right, let's move over to our news items. Bob, you're going to start us off by talking about the periodic table, one of my favorite tables.
I like the water table.
Absolutely.
That's a good one, too.
It's a good one, yeah.
So, guys, in the past 20 years, and after a lot of effort, you guys know this, scientists have discovered a bunch of new elements that are now, they're in the periodic table right now.
And obtainium.
They're the next discoveries, though, the ones that are going to come after, the ones that we're going to see next are going to be even harder and more elusive. But some scientists now think that they are closer than we may think. And they actually have a plan to make those discoveries come even faster than in the past. So this is this study is coming from nuclear physicists at the Riken Nishina Center for Accelerator-Based Science. And it's all about creating new elements. Have you ever wondered How do you actually do that? What goes into creating new elements? And it's maybe it's not what you think. It's essentially what they're doing is smashing nuclei together.
Yeah,
they're not building them piece by piece. They smash them together at extremely high speeds. So usually you have one element as a target, and then you hit that with a beam of ions from a second element traveling at thousands of miles per second, get a lot of speed going. And so if you look at 2016, in that year, we actually had four elements. See if you remember, we had four elements that were added to the periodic table at the same time in terms of like they were named and they were added officially to the periodic table all at the same time in 2016. So if you haven't looked at the periodic table in a bunch of years, take another look at it. So these were elements 113, 115, 117, and 118, nihonium, moscovium, tennessine, and organeson. So these are called super heavy elements. These are special. These are heavier than rutherfordium, which is element 104. And that all that means
awesome,
is Rutherford. Yeah, all that means is super heavy means that it's not found in nature. And even if they were created by some bizarre natural processes on the Earth that don't exist and maybe even couldn't exist on the Earth, they wouldn't even last because they quickly decay. They're radioactive. They decay to lighter elements. They would not last very long at all. And when you look at these super heavy elements, generally speaking, the heavier it is, you know, the more neutrons, the more protons, the shorter the lifetime is going to be. So, for example, nihonium, which is element 113, has a half-life of nearly 8 seconds. If you look at organeson, though, element 118, it's just 0.7 milliseconds. And there's definitely a trend in that direction. Heavier, the more unstable the elements are. But one thing you may not have known about these last elements that were fleshed out in 2016, the periodic table's seventh row or period, right? There's seven periods. That's why it's called the periodic table. The seventh row was finally filled in. That row is done.
Sold out.
So that leaves basically at this point two huge goals that might be closer to discovery than we think, at least according to these scientists. And the first one, you know, the first goal, of course, is obvious. Fill out the new eighth period of the periodic table. Now, we would know because of the nature of the periodic table, and it's called the period law, I think, we know that these rows of elements share similar chemical and physical properties, right? That's how it's laid out. So what would the properties be for this eighth period or row in the periodic table? We don't know. Let's find out. But how much better would that new row be if it consisted not only of elements with ever increasingly fleeting lives, you know, shorter and shorter lifetimes, half lives. But what if it consisted of elements that could last for days or weeks or millennia? What kind of chemistry could we perform? What kind of materials could potentially be made with elements that are super heavies, but last for a really long time and don't disappear in the blink of an eye, or much less than the blink of an eye? So this is where the whole idea of the island of stability comes in. I probably mentioned it a few times on the show, and that's the second big goal, is to flesh out or even prove the existence of this island of stability. When that idea is that there's this sea, that within the sea of unstable super heavy nuclei, there's some grouping of elements that have what's called these magic numbers of neutrons and protons, specific ratios of them in the nucleus that make even super heavy elements especially stable. And that's what they think could be out there. So at the center then of this island, you would see one or two or three or more exotic elements that last for potentially a long time, much longer than you would ever expect. And, you know, this really isn't just like, oh, wouldn't it be nice if this were true? There's actually some proof that this concept of an island of stability is sound. And that came during the synthesis of element 117. So 117 decayed very quickly, right? It decayed very fast, and it decayed into an isotope of lawrencium, which is element 103, which is just below the superheavies. Now, this isotope of lawrencium had never been seen before. You know, we created lawrencium. It was discovered. It was named. They found these isotopes, but it didn't last that long. This isotope, which they just happened to find, lasted for 11 hours. And that's a long time for a heavy element. That's a really long time. So yeah, so like I said, previous elements, you know, previous isotopes of Lawrencium didn't last very long. But this isotope, Lawrencium-266, had 103 protons and 163 neutrons. So those were unknown. They're kind of like those magic numbers of protons and neutrons. And we hadn't known of those two, at least anyway. So that means that there could be other unknown magic combinations or quantities of protons and neutrons in other elements that could make them even more and more stable. So that's the background. So that's the interesting background, at least what I think is a very interesting background for this. Now, the crux of the Riken scientist stuff was that that discovering new elements is difficult. Obvious, right? It takes a lot of work. You know, which particles do you smash together? Jay, what do you think? Do you know? Who knows?
Oxygen, hydrogen.
Oxygen.
Other so, heavy ones?
Right. It's, but you know, typically it's like a small one and a bigger one, but how do you do it? What angles? I mean, there's lots of things that you got to figure out. And they say that it could take 3 months to synthesize an atom. 3 months. And that's because they need to know how the various repulsive and attractive forces surrounding the two nuclei interact as they approach each other. You really need to have a handle on how, you know, the angle and how they would interact so that they would glom together and not just, you know, stay as a new element, at least for a little while. So the Riken scientists discovered that if the smaller particle approaches the larger particle from a specific angle, it will increase its chances to make a super heavy atom and not just fly apart, right? Like all our 401ks during this pandemic. And it'll just like stay together. So instead of taking months to figure these calculations and equations out, they say that these calculations based on this study could take potentially a day or so, just a day. So they can shave many months off of this process. So one of the scientists said, from this systematic study, we've proposed a new method to estimate the optimum incident energy to synthesize a new element. And that quotes from Taika Waititi. Oh, wait, not Taika Waititi. Yeah. He can direct. He can direct, but he's not a nuclear physicist yet. That quote was from Taiki Tanaka of Riken. So in the future, the team plans what? Obvious, right? They want to use this knowledge to make new super heavy elements. Tanaka says again, in the short term, we will try to make new elements such as elements 119 or 120. In a decade or two, we want to reach the island of stability, but we're not sure where it is. And this new study could accelerate the process of finding that element, that island of stability, if it exists. And man, to me, that's like one of the top 10 scientific discoveries I've been waiting for, is this proof of this island of stability and what kind of bizarre, fascinating chemistry we might be able to do with these elements that last for long enough to do real chemistry with them.
I like how you describe it as an island. I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wish I coined it, but yeah. And they talk about being on the shores of the island of stability. It's a fun metaphor. Yeah, yeah.
But we still don't know about how stable we're talking about, right? I mean, do they think it'll be 12 seconds instead of 8 seconds half life?
Right.
Or,
well, the whole idea, I mean, we're finding some like the Lawrencium, 11 hours. That's a long time. You could actually do potentially some chemistry if you've got 11 hours before it decays into simpler elements.
Not going to build bridges out of it, though.
No, you're not. But the idea, though, Steve, is that this is the special kind of, you know, it's an island of stability where it's especially, you know, magical in terms of the ratios of neutrons and protons, and especially stable. So yeah, so maybe it could be a day or a week, or who knows? I mean, let's find out. It could be something that's especially long lived that we could even make stuff out of. I don't know, or at least find out what are the chemical properties of this eighth row and this eighth period, and what kind of chemical properties could it have, and you know, maybe do some chemistry. How fascinating would that be?
Yeah, that'd be cool. All right, Jay. There's tens of thousands of studies looking at coffee and caffeine showing this and that. You're going to tell us about a recent one trying to identify which coffee is the quote unquote safest.
Wait, there's unsafe coffee?
Apparently there is, Evan.
Oh,
I don't drink it,
but
or
that,
unsafe.
That,
yeah, for
that
humans. Yeah.
Me.
So one thing I noticed during the pandemic, right, is that my coffee intake went up by 50%. Right, so let me ask, Bob, if I go from two cups to three cups, isn't that a 50% increase?
Yeah, I guess. Wow, Jay, right? That's three. Just three? That's it?
Yeah, I never let myself go above three. That's my absolute limit on any day.
All right, I guess.
So recent studies researched if there's a link between how you brew your coffee and the risks of heart attack and death. Now, right out of the gate, I'm thinking like, why would they even go? Why would you even say that about coffee? But apparently there was some information or data that they had to make them put together this study. And Steve was correct. There's been tons of studies about coffee. So the conclusion was published in the European Journal of Preventive Cardiology. And here's what it is. So first off, what do you guys think was the safest way from a health perspective to brew coffee?
So you're talking brewing, not roasting.
Brewing. Just the
brewing.
You know, yeah. Basically, you go out to a restaurant, you go to a coffee shop, or you're at home, you're going to make coffee. What's the right way to make it from a health perspective?
Oh, gosh. No, I mean, how... I mean, it's probably
just drip.
It's probably some sort of thing that requires minimal plastic content or something like that.
Something that limits the oils that gets into the coffee, some kind of oil limiting factor.
Oils? What oils? You mean from the beans?
Yeah, there's oils in the beans.
Oh, Keurig. Okay.
Keurig.
Yeah, right. Keurig.
All right. So, Evan, you hit upon it.
Hey, and I don't even drink it.
You don't want to use a French press. You want to use filtered coffee. You want to have a filter in the process of making the coffee. So the research team actually concluded that unfiltered coffee has certain chemicals that increase blood cholesterol. Mm. However, if you use a typical paper filter, heart attack and premature death are so much less likely. They're down to nil. So this is a big deal because coffee is incredibly popular. It's a global phenomenon. Coffee-related products make up 1.6% of the total U.S. gross domestic product. Now, globally, how much money do you think coffee does a year globally?
Billions.
In sales?
Yeah.
Billions.
20 billion.
Quintillion dollars.
Tens of billions, I think.
20 billion.
100 billion.
Wow.
What?
Yep. I mean, it's like the number one export of certain nations. Like, that is their GDP, yeah.
So researchers discovered over 30 years ago that coffee drinking was linked to an increase of LDL cholesterol. And as you know, this is considered bad cholesterol. So back then, okay, they found out that it had an impact enough to put your heart health at risk.
And that was controlled for people drinking, like, milk and cream and stuff?
Yes, they did. So this study I was very impressed with this study because they did such a wonderful job of factoring in all of the data. I'll get into that in a second. So the researchers set up a large population study that took place for almost 20 years. They did not want to subject people to something that they thought could hurt them. So they said, let's just find real world people out there that are already drinking it instead of, like, you know, making a test group that has to drink it, which is very easy. So in 1985 to 2003, those are the years that the study ran, they had 508,747 male and female test subjects between the ages of 20 and 79. Wow. Wow. That's a big test. They collected details about the amount and type of coffee that they drank, along with a ton of other variables that had an impact on heart disease. And all these data were factored into the study. They were able to track to participants an average of 20 years. 46,341 participants died during the testing. Of those participants that died, 12,621 deaths were due to cardiovascular disease. And of those that died of cardiovascular disease, 6,202 were the result of a heart attack.
That's about half of them?
Yeah. So when you'd go from the amount of people that died, I'll just do rough numbers now. 46,000 people died, 12,000 died of cardiovascular disease, and 6,000 died of heart attacks. So another study had similar results. Consumption of 1 liter unfiltered coffee just for 2 weeks significantly raised fasting plasma homocysteine concentrations by 10%, from 12.8 to 14.8 micromilliwatts. You know,
milliliters?
Hoosie-watzers. No, it specifically says milli-hoosie-watzers.
Does it? Very technical.
Yeah, micromillimeter. Right. So anyway.
Okay. There's a small letter M followed by a small letter L.
Is it a mu or an M? Is it an?
It's a micro.
Is it an M or a mu?
M-O-L. M-O-L dash L.
It's micro moles per liter.
Thank you.
How do you drink unfiltered coffee? You're specifically just saying, like, a French press, right? Because nobody just brews beans in hot water and just drinks all that slop.
Yeah, there's lots of ways to get unfiltered coffee. There's lots of different, all culturally, you know, you can have machines that make coffee, or, you know, things that make coffee from around the world. I've seen a lot of them at my brother-in-law's house, by the way. He's got a collection of, like, from around the world, you know, and it's really cool because they all vary, but a lot of them don't really use filters.
He has a civet in a tree.
No. No, there are no civets.
There's a difference between filtered and screened. A French press is screened. It really,
right.
It's just pushing like this mesh of metal through the coffee and it gets away all the chunks, but you're getting way more saturation and you're getting way more like stuff from the crushed beans, way more like particulate. And that's where this stuff lives. So let me put your mind at ease here, though, because we kind of jumped off the rails real quick. Filtered coffee was oddly considered safer than no coffee at all.
What?
No, yeah. So that's – so I could jump in here a little bit. Yeah, as I said at the beginning, there's tons of research. And at the bottom line is even right now, we still don't really know what the net effect is because, again, confounding factors are massive. Most of the data is observational, not experimental. Basically taking people asking them how much coffee they drink and then seeing what happens to them. But rather than saying, all right, you drink 3 cups of coffee per day and you drink, you know, whatever, 4 placebo coffees, like that, those kind of studies are not really out there. So there's some research which shows reduction in some kinds of disease, like Parkinson's disease, weirdly. And then there's other research which shows for heart health that it may stiffen the arteries, but then it may not stiffen the arteries, but then there's a decrease in overall mortality. But then it depends on if you have baseline high blood pressure, you should probably minimize your caffeine. And then, like, you know, then there's like no coffee versus 1 to 3 cups a day versus more cups per day versus, you know. So if we distill it all down, and I read a bunch of reviews just to see what's the common themes there. I think if you're having, you know, 1, 2, 3 cups of coffee per day, it probably all comes out in the wash.
What about 6?
Right.
Yeah, that's what I wanted.
6 might be different.
6 is different than 3, Bob. And I read that specifically.
When you get north of 5, then the advice becomes more cautious, saying that, yeah, you know, can't really. The more coffee you drink per day, the less we can say, you know, confidently about the safety of it. But there, even at the low end, there might even be some protective effect there. It actually may reduce atherosclerosis. So, you know, if it's having multiple effects in different directions, it probably leads to a different net effect in different people. Also, do you put sugar and cream in your coffee?
Sure, yeah, right. Yeah, that's right.
What's the effect of the calories of that sugar and the cream that you're putting in? So, there's a lot of variables in there. It's really very, very, very tricky area. So we're not saying like this one study is the final word or is, you know, making any bottom line recommendations. I kind of gave you the overview of the broad picture. And what the bottom line is, we don't really know, which to me usually means it comes out in the wash. Don't worry. As long as you're at the low end.
Well, they specifically say though, Steve,
everything in moderation,
filtered coffee, basically. The filtered coffee,
if you're going to drink,
definitely
it.
Is less risky than non-filtered coffee. I mean, they had,
right.
You know, unless there's a major flaw in this particular study, they had 508,000 people, you know, that's a lot of people to track.
Yeah, but it's usually, it's confounding factors because it's, you know, it's not controlled or randomized.
So but they're not saying like do or don't drink coffee. They're saying if you're going to drink coffee, our findings show drink filtered coffee, it's a little bit safer. And that's really, I think, why nutrition research is so confusing to the general public, because you always hear them saying things like, okay, one day eggs are good, the next day they're bad. Yeah. I should have salt, I shouldn't have salt. And it's like, well, it's so dependent on your own health.
Yeah, and your subpopulation and, you know, confounding. Yeah, so many variables.
And everything not everything, but I think you could almost universally look into any food substance and find a compound that is beneficial and a compound that is dangerous in certain, you know, concentrations. And so that's where it's about variation in your diet and all the things we usually say.
Don't overdo it. Like, Bob, you are definitely overdoing it. Now listen, Bob, I love coffee. I believe that smiles turn into miles. You know what I mean? Like you get some of the things you love and you take care of yourself, you'll live a happier life. You might live a longer life. But Jesus Christ, like some people overdo it. And Bob, you overdo it. You're drinking coffee as if today's the last day that coffee is available.
Bob, this is not a podcast. This is an intervention.
It is. So anyway, but the quick
it's
summary.
It's flavored water.
No. That's what an addict says.
That's true. The quick summary is.
You're in denial.
Oh my God. I'm so not worried. That
yes, that's the first stage of denial, Bob.
Steve,
going.
Back me up.
Yeah, okay, you're in that moderately high amount of coffee zone where we can't be as definitive about its safety.
They said 1 to 4 cups a day, Bob, and that means I'm good and you're not.
Eight ounce cups, not four, those 20 ounce cups.
Yeah, that's a one. A cup is 8 ounces. I have to get into that with all my patients because for migraines, like you should not be drinking caffeine if you have migraines.
Oh shit!
And so I have to quantify their caffeine intake. So some patients, yeah, I have like 3-4 cups a day, but their mugs, quote unquote giant cups are 32 ounce. Yeah, coffee.
The super gulp.
Yeah, Bob, yeah, fill it up, Bob. I'm in your category. Never mind. I have 20-ounce coffee cups in my house.
Mm-hmm. And this is why you should drink espresso. It's just a shot or two, and you know exactly how much it is.
Occasionally, I get patients who measure their coffee intake in pots, not cups.
Wow. I love that.
I just pull it right off the machine.
Jay, I wonder if the fact that I metabolize caffeine so fast, I wonder if that makes a difference.
No,
I'm sure that's an upregulation or a downregulation. Like that's some sort of adaptation to how much coffee you drink.
No,
that's some kind of mutation.
Genetic variation.
There are genetic fast and slow metabolizers of caffeine. If you're a slow caffeine metabolizer, you're a slow metabolizer, and you have to really limit your caffeine intake.
Kara, I went from 30 cups of caffeinated coffee a week to 30 cups of decaf, and I did that for like a few weeks. Did not notice any difference.
He doesn't notice.
I was like, not
wait,
a headache.
Did you notice? When you went back to more caffeine?
Then
did you feel jittery?
Not even a blip.
Wow.
It was irrelevant. Yeah, irrelevant.
If I drink one full diner size mug of drip coffee, like the pot kind,
yes.
Yeah, I'm shaking.
Yeah, me too, Kara.
I've never had one shake from any caffeine ever.
I got to go back to Steve's measuring cups to pots thing. People that measure their coffee drinking in pots are also people that have lit cigarettes from their mouth while they're talking. It's the same guy. You know what
they
I
got
mean?
One in their mouth and
in
they're
their
neurology.
Well, there is. See, that's the thing. There is an association. If you drink a lot of coffee, you're more likely to drink alcohol. You're more likely to smoke. You're more likely to be overweight. So there's
none of those.
Yeah,
but that's the thing. So those are confounding factors
right.
when we're looking at the statistics. And you have to try to factor them out, but it's always hard because then if those things go along with it, are there other things that go along with it? You know what I mean? Like, it's really hard to completely eliminate all of the confounding factors. So have you guys seen the Pentagon UFO videos?
Yes, for years.
Yeah, I saw that you wrote about it.
They've been going around for a couple
nothing
of years.
Nothing burger.
Yeah, exactly. Giant nothing burger. But the Pentagon officially released the videos today, basically ending any speculation about are they genuine, are they really from the Pentagon? And so they're real videos from the Pentagon. And they are now officially in the public domain. But what are they? If you haven't seen them, you can go to my blog, you can find them online, the Pentagon UFO videos. There's a few different ones there. And so, a lot is being made of it because, these were made by pilots and, the old saw that, pilots are trained observers and they're used to, being in three-dimensional space, et cetera.
Argument from authority?
Yeah, it's a type of argument from authority. So what are these videos? How impressive are they as evidence for something alien?
As impressive as any other video for something alien?
Yeah. I mean, so they have that common feature that all of these videos have, and that is that they're blurry. They're indistinct blobs.
Blob
right?
Squatch.
They're not. It's not exactly. They're blob squatch or the UFO version of blob squatch. So they're not ships. You know what I mean? It's not like you're looking at the Enterprise. You're looking at a black smudge. The question is, how could we infer what that black smudge is by its apparent behavior on the video? That's where I think the UFO enthusiasts go off the deep end, is they make all kinds of unjustifiably confident conclusions about what appears to be happening. And then from that, they say, well, this has to be some kind of spaceship that can, exceed the performance of even our, modern aircraft. So here's the thing. There is a reason why every picture that's not a proven fraud, right? There are obviously fakes out there. But picture taken in the wild, sincerely, that is interpreted as either being, Sasquatch or a UFO is blurry and indistinct. And the reason is because the pictures that are in focus are not Bigfoot or alien spacecraft. Right. Because when it's in focus, you know that it isn't those things. It's
so these are like false positives.
Yeah. It's only the ones that are exactly. It's a very non-specific test. So the only the pictures that leave a lot to the imagination then get put out there as pictures of something like Bigfoot or a UFO, an alien spacecraft. Or it's just anomaly hunting, I think, is the other big thing that is going on. So this was part of a program by the Pentagon to catalog these, what they're calling unidentified aerial phenomenon, to get away from the UFO thing. They had a very serious reason for doing this. They wanted to know, they're basically interested in detecting foreign tech or testing, you know. They want to know if Russia is building spy drones, you know, or are testing new weapons or what new capability, whatever, new spacecraft, new aircraft. And so they want any anomalies, anything that's unusual, they want to review to see, is this anything that could potentially be a threat, you know, to American airspace? They're not ostensibly looking for aliens, and that's not the purpose of the program. So what are these videos? So like one, again, is this black smudge in the middle of the video. The other thing about it is, not only can you not see what it is, because it's in the air, right? You really have no idea how big it is, how far away it is, how fast it's moving. And that's true of all of these videos. It's very easy to be fooled by an unusual optical illusion. And you could say, well, what are the odds, you know, that this would be like just such a bizarre optical illusion? It's like, well, pretty good if you're combing three videos from, I don't know, hundreds, thousands of candidates. Of all the possible encounters that pilots have had, these were the three, you know, that got released as, yeah, these are, you know, we don't know what these are, what phenomenon is going on here. These are the unusual ones. So there's always going to be a residue, like in any kind of project like this, of things that are just quirky, just weird, that you can't explain.
Yeah, we call them outliers.
Yeah, they're outliers. These are outliers, exactly. And we don't necessarily, I mean, it's nice when we can definitively explain what they are, but even if we can't, that doesn't mean that they're alien spacecraft or that there's something beyond, you know, the mundane.
Yeah, you're not allowed to just insert your favorite fantasy or story or idea in place of the evidence.
Right, exactly, whatever that is. So as somebody who's been following the UFO phenomenon for probably, I would say, fairly 45 years, you know, starting out as a believer, you know, when I was 10, you know, I thought, hey, yeah, sure. There's all that crap going on there. Documentaries on TV were pretty gullible. You know, if you're a 10-year-old watching In Search Of, you know, you think that, God, you know, there's UFOs all over the place. One thing that's interesting is that even as a believer, I became increasingly disappointed, you know, because the community sort of creates, and these you know, gushing documentaries create this sense that, yeah, like any day now, they're going to be landing on the White House lawn, you know, like we're sort of nibbling around the edges of a real phenomenon. And as we get closer and closer to the core, the really interesting evidence is going to start to come out. But then it never happens.
Yeah.
Steve,
it reminds me of when we asked the Warrens, give us your best evidence. And they gave us a video that we basically ripped apart.
It was the ghost blob. It was the same thing. It was at that perfect distance to be provocative but not distinct, where you can make where you could positively ID it.
Or it's the one where the kid disappeared, and it's like, somebody stopped the camera.
That guy disappeared.
Yeah, we basically proved that the camera was stopped and restarted.
Wrong.
Yeah, and I think a lot of believers go through that. You know, where at some level they're waiting for like the really impressive evidence that just never comes into existence. And then that was crystallized for me, you know, by Carl Sagan in Cosmos, when he pointed out, yeah, you know, it's been decades now, and there isn't a single piece of unambiguous evidence, not a single piece. What are the odds, if we were being buzzed by alien spacecraft, what are the odds that we wouldn't have gotten one clean photo by now, you know?
Right, especially in the age of the smartphone. I mean, millions of them in everyone's pocket.
And look on YouTube, there is
HD.
There's in-focus, distinct, good-quality video, amateur video, of all kinds of rare and weird phenomena, but not spacecraft, right? But not alien spacecraft, not ghosts, not Bigfoot, not any of these things that don't exist. We're still looking at black smudges. Why are we looking at black smudges? Because right. that's because you can't tell what it is. That's the only reason why it's of any interest. Because you not that it's a UFO, but because you can't know for sure what it is. So
Yeah, it goes through a filter. You know, that goes through the filter of, all right, here's the obvious ones that are in focus. We know what that is. And it's not a UFO. And then so what's left is you got this cream of the crop of perfectly indistinct stuff that, yeah. Oh boy, and let your imagination and pareidolia go wild. Like, oh, wow, look at that.
Steve, when you're describing this as, you know, always just being on the cusp of making a breakthrough in which we're finally going to see everything, it reminds me of free energy gurus in a sense who pitch to people. It's like, we almost got this thing where, you know, we're so close to the breakthrough
Evan,
and
that's
we're about
the hype,
to release
baby.
It. We just need a little more.
That's just getting the juices flowing so people jump on, you know?
Right. Absolutely, yep.
Yeah, and I've encountered different kinds of people over the years. So there are definitely the UFO believers who that's their career, you know? They're in for the long haul. That's it. You know, they're true believers. And then there are those who I think hop, you know? Like they may be into UFOs for a while, and that gets boring because, you know, at this, like if you've been doing this for 30 years, are you really going to get excited over a black smudge? You know, or a white dot skimming along the water. You know, no, it's not going to get excited. So they move on to something else. Then they move on to Bigfoot, or they move on to free energy, or whatever. So they're always in that exciting, oh, we're on the cusp of proving this, you know, thing. And then that sort of burns itself out. Then they go on to the next thing. But then there are those who like start to wake up and realize, oh, maybe it's always black smudges because there are no UFOs. Oh, yeah, maybe. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe that's what it is. There are no alien spacecraft. There's maybe so it's blob squatch is blob squatch. It the phenomenon is the blurry photo. That is the phenomenon, is the blurry photo. Not there's no creature behind there, or no aliens, or no ghosts, or whatever.
Yeah, the only other option is that Bigfoot
is blurry
by definition. Yeah. Blurry. That's how he is. He's exists as a blurry creature.
Well, he exists, Bob, in two different dimensions simultaneously. That's why.
That's right.
Two.
Wait, who says that?
Special, you hear that special pleading. Oh, yeah. Bigfoot is psychic, so he knows when people are about to take pictures of him, or that he can dimension travel, and that's how come he's so elusive, and you know, and we don't see the bodies, you know, whatever. You could special plead your way out of anything. The aliens want to exist right on the cusp of our perception and not, you know, why? They want to imitate black smudges on our photos. I mean, they came all this way to do that. I mean...
Would you like to hear a comment I posted on this on Facebook today?
Here was my comment.
There are hundreds, likely thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of hours of compiled, quote, UFO footage, quote, unquote, over the last 5 decades. Number of seconds of credible footage? Zero.
Right.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. Let's move on. Kara, some good news. I understand
that
there is a malaria vaccine, not a COVID-19 vaccine yet, but a malaria vaccine. Tell us about
That's awesome.
Right. It's good news, but it's also, you know, complicated and I think a little bit nuanced news. It's an important story to talk about because I do think that we are so consumed with COVID-19 news. And of course, I think it feels so relevant to us here in the States, but we can't forget that during a global pandemic, all of the other infectious pathogens don't just like lay in wait. They don't go quiet. You know, people are still getting sick from other things. And not just that, sometimes when healthcare interests shift, the things that are making people sick or have been making people sick in the background don't really get the attention that they require. So I do think that it's a timely and telling story about this new malaria vaccine. It's actually not that new, but it's just now... between 2019 and 2020, gone into a phase 4 clinical trial, which is actually, it's like an extension of a phase 3. So phase 3 showed that it is effective, and we'll talk about that because it's effective to a point, that it's effective and that it's safe. Phase 4 is more like a pilot vaccination program for certain countries. So this program is happening right now in Kenya, Malawi, and Ghana. And it's the vaccine is called RTSS, and it's the only malaria vaccine that in trials has been shown to provide partial protection against malaria in young children. So this is something that's really important to remember. Researchers have been looking to develop a malaria vaccine for decades. And they just really haven't been terribly successful. RTSS, was actually created in 1987 at GSK Laboratories. And then with the support of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, along with PATH and a few other organizations, they were finally able in 2001 to start developing the vaccine for children living in endemic regions, regions with endemic malaria. And also, we've got to remember that this vaccine works against Plasmodium falciparum, which is the parasite that causes malaria in these sub-Saharan African regions. This is different than the parasite that causes malaria in places like South and Central America. So this vaccine would not work in those regions. And this is, if you actually go to the CDC or you go to the WHO website and you're, you know, wanting to travel, not now, of course, but if you're wanting to travel to a part of the world that has malaria, you will find a chart that talks about all the different anti-malarial drugs that are on the market and which ones work for which type of malaria are in those regions, because different mosquitoes are carrying different pathogens, and those different pathogens is caused by a Plasmodium, cause different infections. And so you don't want to take the wrong drug. It's not going to work. But let's go on to RTSS. So Ghana, Kenya, and Malawi, which I mentioned, are doing the vaccine introduction program. It's a large-scale pilot attempting to vaccinate 360,000 children per year across those three countries. And it's part of their routine immunization program. I think that it's a four-shot series. Between the ages of, like, between kind of soon after birth all the way to, I think, the age of 2 years old. And so that's one of the downfalls that we'll get into, which is that we're talking about a vaccine program in parts of the world, you know, in big cities in these countries. Great. These vaccine programs are probably going to be relatively successful, but in places where it's hard for people to travel to get to the clinic, having to do it multiple times, each new dose is probably going to have a lower rate of, what's the word, Steve, the clinical word for like...
Compliance.
Compliance, yeah, exactly. So that's going to change the effectiveness, because we know that the vaccine is not as effective if you get fewer than the required four doses. You know, the big question with this vaccine is sort of what's the cost-benefit analysis. So you've got researchers and clinicians in parts of the world where malaria is wreaking havoc. And we're talking 228 million people get sick and 430,000 people die per year from malaria. And a lot of this is in sub-Saharan Africa. This is, you know, it's crippling. Like, it's not just expensive, but it's incredibly painful. I remember talking to a malaria researcher once, and she had gotten malaria, and I was asking her what it was like. And she said, it's worse than the worst flu you've ever had. And we've talked about this a lot on the show, but the flu sucks. And we often misremember our flu experiences and we kind of conflate it with a bad cold, but it's not. The flu is much worse than a bad cold.
Yeah, it's
and
bad.
So, yeah, it's bad. So imagine the worst flu you've ever had. Maybe it landed you in the hospital and you needed a saline drip. Maybe it didn't, but you were like having delusions because your fever was so high. Or maybe you were just super sick and laid out in bed for a whole week or, you know, 3-4 days, but it was brutal. Malaria is worse. Bad fevers, lethargy, chills, you know, joint pain. And sometimes people are laid out for weeks. Like, we're talking 3 weeks in bed. And it's a pretty difficult thing in some of these sub-Saharan regions because the medical bills for individuals are high. I mean, not by our standards. We're talking maybe like $300 or $400 US for a malaria treatment, but by the standards of the, you know, value of the local currency, insurmountable for a lot of people. And what we'll often see is that these people go to get treatment, they can't pay their bills. And then, so they sort of just have to stay at the hospital until they can pay. And sometimes they're more at risk in the hospital because many hospitals don't have access to what is one of the most important ways to prevent malaria.
Netting.
And a lot of times, yes, exactly. And a lot of times people can't access these nets, and some hospitals don't have nets for their beds, and this can be a really dangerous combination. But we do know that netting works, and we do know that it works really well. We also know that insecticides work, and they work really well, but they can't, and they've proven not to be the full solution to the problem, because of course you can't live under a mosquito net. You can only sleep under a mosquito net. spraying within the home can help, but there are lots of places where standing water, which is the place where these mosquitoes will breed, is necessary. It's incapable because of the type of farming that's happening in these regions, or the way that people go to the bathroom with open latrines, that you simply can't get rid of the standing water. And so we have, you know, these ingredients that are coming together to create good breeding grounds for malaria causing mosquitoes or malaria spreading mosquitoes. And so the real question with this malaria vaccine is the cost benefit worth it? Now, we know that it took 34 years, I referenced that before, for it to, or 35 years for it to fully come to fruition. It's also taken hundreds of millions of dollars in R&D. And then the really interesting thing is, among children aged 5 to 17 months who've received all four doses, so we're talking about people who actually were able to take the required doses, the vaccine prevented 39% of cases of malaria over 4 years of follow-up, and 29% of cases of severe malaria. Severe malaria is defined by those who need life-affirming treatment. Like, it's life-threatening. They've ended up in the hospital. They probably have anemia. They may need blood transfusions. So, you know, 4 in 10, 3 in 10, which is massive if you have no protection.
Mm-hmm.
But it's obviously not what we're used to when we think of vaccines.
Yeah.
Like, we think of, well, I'm just not going to get it. Or if I get it, I'm not going to get that sick. And here we're talking, okay, I still have a majority chance of getting sick, but my chance is lessened significantly. So the question for a lot of people is the cost, the difficulty to get it, and the kind of cultural shifts that would be required for individuals to start doing a massive vaccine program against malaria worth it? And some researchers and clinicians are saying, yes, we'll take all we can get, you know, one more option. That's, you know, one more tool in our tool belt. It's just going to continue to reduce. And other people are saying, I don't really know. I mean, if we could actually be just doing some of the simpler things that cost a lot less money, like getting mosquito nets to the places where they're needed, because we know that there's still places where people don't have access to mosquito nets. So should we be prioritizing our funding and our attention there? The Nat Geo article about this actually brought up another idea, which is kind of tangentially related, which is fascinating to me. There's a drug called artemisinin, I think. And of course, there's a lot of anti-malarials. It was developed in China in the 70s. It's given as a therapy called ACT, artemisinin combination therapy. And they are interested, and this has actually been done in the African nation of Comoros, which is an island nation. So we have to remember that it's made up of four islands. But on three of the four islands, they've basically eliminated, not eradicated, but eliminated malaria by giving every single person on the island this MDA. It's called a Mass Drug Administration of ACT, artemisinin combination therapy. And so basically, what it does is, a mosquito's life cycle is 30 days. It's only 30 days. So if they can medicate every person, it's going to kill the plasmodium. Then the mosquitoes are going to bite people, but they're not transmitting any malaria parasites. And so eventually, the mosquitoes themselves aren't carrying it anymore. New mosquitoes are born, but the people don't have the malaria to give to the mosquitoes to give to more people. And so they've actually found that it worked on an island, but a lot of people are really skeptical as to whether you could do this mass drug administration protocol in a, you know, busy or very you know, urban center, or in places where it's very hard to get to people because they live in very rural areas. But it's an interesting idea, and it's another tool in the World Health Organization's Global Malaria Program tool belt that they're starting to look into. So, you know, yes, it's exciting that there is a vaccine, but yes, that vaccine should be part of a combination. And the WHO actually says that it's a combination of therapies and preventive measures, because malaria is a tough cookie and we should be doing all that we can. And we should be, I think, smart about where we put our money and how effective these kinds of things can be, because we're talking about, in many ways, almost insurmountable obstacles to treatment.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I do, because yeah, I'd like to think about ways in which our thinking gets biased, obviously, is a core skeptical thing. And I do think there is a high-tech bias. We see that in medicine, just, you know, in general, like you want to throw the highest tech solution at a problem because it seems like it should be the most
it's
effective.
It's going to be better.
Yeah. It's always got to be better. But sometimes it's all – what only really matters is how effective is it, and that mm-hmm. includes how cost effective it is. And often low tech solutions are much more cost effective because almost by definition they're cheaper. And mm-hmm. so, you know, but yeah, it just doesn't feel, it just, it's aesthetically doesn't feel as good, right? To say we're going to treat this problem with netting, with nets, like some
right,
really
that have been around for
basic,
you know, decades. Thing.
Yeah. As opposed to, you know, so, you know, we're going to science it out of existence with a vaccine. It just feels more satisfying. But
yeah, I think it's two things, right? You said it's more cost effective. And also there's this idea of like implementation.
Yeah.
And that contributes to efficacy too. Like you can give a net to a person and show them how to use it in a sentence or two. Whereas to vaccinate a 4-dose vaccine requires traveling to a mm-hmm. clinic and having trained individuals,
yeah.
Which is very dangerous. And, you know, there are other things that we could be doing more of, which is like testing blood for malaria prior to transfusions. I have a friend, mm-hmm. well, I have a friend of a friend who actually got malaria in the hospital in treatment for an injury that they sustained in the field in Namibia. And that's because, or actually, I think they were in the Congo when they got malaria from their transfusion because it's such a common infection. Mm-hmm. So just, you know, preventing what is called iatrogenic.
Iatrogenic, no. Yeah.
Yes, infection. Exactly. And also contribute – or another conversation about that is I think that sometimes we're falling victim to this like sunk cost fallacy. It's like, but we've put so much money into developing this vaccine. Now we got to use it. Yeah,
yeah,
and that's a hard thing.
Right, right. But that doesn't mean that a vaccine, if it were effective and practical, wouldn't be a great thing. And sometimes
not.
Also I think we need to lateral over to a new technology that might not necessarily be superior than existing options, but it gives us the ability to then continue to improve from there because now we're on a new track. So there doesn't, you know, short term, there may not be an advantage to the higher tech thing, but it may give us the opportunity to advance in the future. So there's a lot of nuance to this, and it's very mm-hmm. individual because people throw that at us too. It's like, oh, like with GM, it's like, oh, you're trying to throw a high tech solution at a problem that could be solved with a cheaper, more, you know, easier low tech solution. Like, no, it's not an either or thing. I want to use every option,
yeah,
right? I want
exactly.
all options to be on the table. Same thing like when you're fighting malaria. It's not like we shouldn't be thinking about the one, you know, coup de grace, right? The one thing that's going to solve the problem in a single stroke. We want to use all of the options to their optimal. Same thing with the energy thing. We can get back to our discussion. I think it was last week about fusion. Fusion isn't necessarily going to be the best option just because it's the sexiest, highest tech one. You know what I mean? You think about it, in 30, 40, 50 years, you know, when fusion becomes practical, which is generous, what's solar and battery tech going to be like at that time? And is fusion really going to be the most cost-effective option at that point?
Yeah.
It may always have it be a niche application. You just never know. Maybe great from a Martian colony, but it may not be, you know, the best option on
Earth.
Can't
wait for our hydrogen economy.
Yeah. And we're also really, I think, you hit the nail on the head when you talked about these biases of like, we're biased about our own community and our own lifestyles. And we kind of tend to think of other people as like us, or we think of them as so different that it's like foreign and alien. But the truth is, Ghana is not Malawi, is not Kenya. Kids who live in cities are different than kids who live in rural areas. You know, people with money are different than people who, or they have different lifestyles than people who are impoverished. And these solutions, it's probably going to be some combination of these multiple approaches that need to be targeted depending on the people that you're working with.
Yeah, yeah. That's the privilege bias, which we talk about.
Exactly.
I remember one thing, you know, speaking about Africa, just like a random memory that comes to mind is that for a time, the optimal AIDS cocktail involved taking medication every 2 hours.
Oh.
And and then, you know, the question was like, well, we'll ship the drugs to, you know, Africa where people are having, you know, there's an AIDS epidemic. It's like, okay, although a lot of the target patient population for these drugs, like, don't have watches, you know, so.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like something you wouldn't think about. You wouldn't think about it because they're living a very different life and a Q2-hour dosing regimen. you know, may not be pragmatic.
Yeah, it's like, you probably, you know, it's like, oh, you got to keep in the refrigerator. It's like, well, there you go.
Yeah,
work,
right.
You know?
This drug needs to be refrigerated. So yeah, that's, well, that is why we do the intention to treat analysis. Mm-hmm. It's not how well does the drug work. How well does prescribing the drug work? And right. If there are practical reasons why you can't take the drug, it doesn't matter if the drug pharmacologically is effective, if it's doesn't fit into pragmatically into the life of the patient that you're intending to treat with it. Mm-hmm. And so that really becomes important when there are, you know, social factors that, absolutely, you know, we may take for granted or not be aware of. All right. Very, very complicated area, but very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, as usual, sometimes Who's That Noisy plays annoying sounds. This is your warning. I do think that this sound could irritate some people. And here it is. Okay, so you hear some people in the background.
Clearly excited about what's happening.
Did he say, look, granny?
Yeah, I think maybe.
Cute.
So, any guesses, guys?
A bottle rocket?
What would granny be looking
no,
at?
No, not even close.
Oh. I don't know.
From the person who never lighted a bottle rocket in her life.
Pretty much.
All right, well, Nicholas Underwood said, hey, my dude, sounds like a power station or the like going through some sort of unhappy meltdown. Lots of arcing going on or going down. That's what's up. Shifty Nick. So that's not correct, although I do see where you were going with that. Evil Eye sent in another guess this week. He said, totally a guess in my head. It sounds like support cables being extended on a cable stay bridge from a spool, and the twanging is where they change direction. I don't know what you're talking about, but it sounded cool. That sounded pretty cool. I'd like to see a video of that, but that's not it. Kevin Weiss said, bumper cars. You are incorrect. I thought that was a fun guess. Bumper cars are a lot of fun. I want some company to make bumper cars V2. You know what I'm talking about?
Like what would they do?
Yeah, version
they
two.
Would be faster. They would be a little bit
bumpier,
a little bit more threatening. Because in the typical bumper car thing, it's like a big hot mess where you never get really enough speed. They steer really weird. I just want to drive a good clip right into somebody, okay?
But that's could what we make it so you don't like get whiplash?
Yeah, we could bolt your head back to the thing.
That'd be
give
cool.
You a helmet.
Perry used to do demolition derbies.
That's right.
Yeah.
So that's more along those lines.
So Jonathan Mills writes in, this week's Who's That Sounds Like Firearms Being Fired at a Grand Piano. The band Tool did this on an album, and the Who's That Noisy sounds like that. That's cool, but that's not what this is. There is no winner this week.
Huh.
Let me tell you what it is. This thing is pretty cool. This is what is called a hail cannon. Anybody ever heard of a hail cannon?
Like it.
Heard of Hail Mary.
Hail?
I know what a t-shirt cannon is. You know, they fire those t-shirts at the concert.
Yeah. No, so this cannon is it's a vertical looking kind of tube that has like a fluty end. And what they do is they use sound waves to break up hail before it can form.
Ooh.
Weird.
Yep.
Like in a cloud?
Well, no, this is ground-based, and they usually will put them over, you know, apple orchards or fruits and things that will get damaged by hail. So if the conditions for hail come, they will turn on the hail cannon, and somehow, through the miracle of physics, those sounds will limit the hail. Okay?
Like now, breaking up kidney
work?
Stones.
Steve, I did look it up, and there's a lot of people that have them. They're out there, so I would imagine they work. I hope they work. But my God, the noise they make, though, huh? It's just a really big whang, you know, just this gigantic. I bet you it's very percussive if you're there, because that's the whole point, is that it's doing something to the formation of hailstones. So if anybody has any legitimate information about the hail cannon, please email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org, because I'd like to know if these are legit machines or not. But anyway. Nonetheless, a very cool noisy. I have a new noisy for everybody this week. All right, so many people sent this in. I picked the first person who sent this in. It happens to be Timothy Wagner. This is a really cute noisy. I'm sure a lot of you were going to guess this correctly, but I had to do it because it's that cute. Just needed to be heard, and here it is.
Oh,
I don't care what it is. I want it.
I know. It's so cute. It's too cute. So that is cute, Kara. That's what cute is.
Thanks. Have you ever seen the show Too Cute?
No.
Oh, highly recommend. Puppies? With the puppies and the kittens. Watch it with your kids. They'll love it.
Careful. All right. Addictive. Doing that tomorrow for sure.
Yep.
So if you think you know what this week's noisy is, or if you heard something, and God, I got some cool noisies this week. I can't wait to share them with you. I have like three I got in 1 week that are really good. But please keep sending them in because I have dry spells. You could send all of this to WTN@theskepticsguide.org. And by the way, just so you know, to be perfectly clear, this is Jay. This is not Bob. This is not Evan.
It's not Kara.
Nobody ever guesses Steve or Kara because they think who's that noisy is below you guys. But this is not Jay or Bob. I mean, this is not Evan or Bob. See how I muddied the water, Evan? You see how they never really know? No, this is Jay. Thank you. Steve, did you know?
Yes, I did.
You did know that Nexus 2020 is an all-digital, all-streaming conference this year. It'll be held on August 1st. However, the day before August 1st, which is July what, by the way? I don't quite remember.
32nd.
31st.
I tried to get you.
Right, the Friday night before. The
Friday night before, which will be July 31st, we will be having an opening ceremony for Nexus 2020, which of course will be streaming as well. That's going to be in the evening. And
that's
going to
be fun.
Having...
Yeah, it's going to be an evening of games with celebrity guests. We already have one person locked in as a contestant. That's Leanne Lord, who was the MC of the conference the last couple of years. We have other invites out. You know, we're not going to mention names until they're totally locked in, but it's going to be fun either way.
Yeah, and we're trying to get it so the audience can play at home, at least keep track at home to see how well that they do.
Yeah.
And then all day Saturday, 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we will be having a conference. And this conference is going to be a little bit different. We have a modified format. We have definitely tried to mix it up because we figured why not experiment right now. So we're having a little bit of a shorter speaker format with more time for discussion after the speaker talks about the talk. So I think it's going to be really cool. I think it's going to work really well. We're going to have a lot of just built-in discussion time, a lot of audience feedback time as well. And we are also working on a lot of ways for people that are there that are watching the conference to interact with each other and us.
Yeah.
So there's heavy on the interaction because it's remote, we're trying very much to build that in. So that is definitely a part of it. And like Steve said last week, there's also a virtual reality element to this that we're going to be experimenting with for fun as well. And you don't need a VR headset to do it. You can just use a regular computer. But if you do have a VR headset, it'll be cooler.
Yeah.
That'll be happening. The big conference will be happening August 1st. You can go to Nexus, NECSS.org to buy tickets. And if you buy a ticket for this year, you will get whatever you donate to us off on your ticket for next year, which is the Atlantic City Conference.
Yeah.
And that one, my friends, you're going to meet your wife or your future husband or whoever, somebody, you're going to meet them at that conference.
Or at least bring your current one.
Yes. If you have
them. All right.
Or if you have a cute dog that's ruining your house, you can bring them to the casino and just drop them off.
Wow. All right. One quick email. This comes from the sign off was Occam's Chainsaw, probably not his real name, from Texas.
I love that.
From Texas.
That's awesome. And,
heck yeah.
and they write, hi, SGU squad. Love the show and wanted to get your take on Dr. Fauci stating, in a pandemic, it is the moral obligation of the researcher to notify the participants who are on the placebo of the positive effects of the actual drug based on the non-published and reviewed results of the study they are participating in. Thanks, stay healthy, and keep up the great work. Well, actually, that's the moral obligation, even not during a pandemic. There's something called informed consent, and the consents have to be, for a clinical trial, have to be approved by the IRB, the Institutional Review Board. And they're very particular about what's in those consent forms to make sure that patients are fully informed. Patients have to know what the potential risks and the potential benefits are based on all the pre-existing science given with the unknowns of the study drug and the probability that they will be on a placebo versus the drug itself. They also have to be reassured that they'll get they will not be denied any existing standard of care for whatever treatment they have, and lots of other things as well. So, yeah, that's standard research practice now. You have to tell patients, yes, you might be getting the placebo, and this is why we think the drug that we're testing may have some benefit, even though it's not, of course, it's still not definitive. That's why we're doing the study, right? But then that's the other side of it, having to tell people the potential risks of the drug that they might be taking. They're told the potential benefits as well. So thanks for that question. So nothing unusual there, that he was just stating standard medical practice. All right, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. There's a theme this week because I just couldn't wade through the COVID-19 news to get to some non-COVID-19 news. So I just came up with a theme. But it was based on a news item that we didn't talk about that's really cool. You guys hear about the crazy beast?
No. This is a mammal
that lived during the time, the end of the dinosaur times. It was found in Madagascar. It's a particularly well-preserved fossil, not because it's complete, not only because it's complete, but it also retains its three-dimensional structure, so it's not flattened like a pancake. But it has really weird teeth. Teeth are critical for assigning fossils, extinct animals, into the evolutionary tree because, one, we have a lot of data because teeth preserve well, and also they're very specific to what the creature eats and everything. So it's a really precise way of tracking relatedness. But there are always outliers and weirdos. And so this is this new creature, which the Latin name literally translates to crazy beast, is like they don't know where it fits into the mammal family tree.
Neat.
Adelotherium, crazy beast. So we'll see, where that ends up fitting in. But so I decided to do a science fiction on extinct mammals, not on this creature. Okay, are you guys ready for some extinct mammals? You ready?
Bob is.
Item number one.
Sounds hard.
Hoplomerix mathii is an extinct deer, 11 to 4.3 million years ago, that sported saber-like upper canine fangs and five horns, including a central horn from its forehead. Item number two, the largest ever confirmed land mammal was a rhino relative, Paraceratherium, standing over 5 meters at the shoulder and weighing up to 4 times more than adult African elephants. And item number three, during the Pleistocene period of Malta, there lived giant swans that were larger and heavier than the local dwarf elephants. Evan, go first.
Yeah. I don't like this one.
I know.
First of all, these things all sound like creatures out of a nightmare. For example, saber-like upper canine fangs of a deer with 5 horns. What is that? What layer of hell did that spawn from? Jeez. Including a central horn from its forehead. Why would you need 5 horns? Oh, boy. With upper canine fangs. Wow, perhaps over 4 million years ago. That's amazing. Saber-like. Okay, the saber-like upper fangs. It's the 5 horns. That is. That's an amazing creature. May I never, ever meet it in my dreams. And then this land mammal being a rhino relative. Oh, boy. 5 meters at the shoulder? 5 meters at the shoulder? Wait, we're talking... Isn't that a giraffe 5 meters at the shoulder or something? That's crazy. And weighing up to 4 times more than an adult African elephant. Oh, my gosh. Well, things were bigger back then. So, bigger was the norm. Last one about the giant swans. Larger and heavier than local dwarf elephants. Well, I wish I knew how large a dwarf elephant was. That might give me a little more perspective. Oh, boy. Geez, you'd think this giant swan would be... No way. Okay, a rhino is a large thing to begin with. So you think that is deer. Okay, there are deer or things in the deer family which maybe get pretty big. But a giant swan? Bird? A swan that big? Oh, I've never even seen anything even resembling close to something like a swan in pictures of prehistoric times. Boy, that one is really standing out. But it's this rhino one at 5 meters at the shoulder. How? Why? Why would that be? Why would it need to grow that large? You know, I mean, there's something about a giraffe being that tall to get the tall, you know, the leaves at the top of the trees and all that. Why the heck would a rhino need to be that large? Rhinos eat meat, do they? I think. Or they eat plants. Damn. Oh, this is so hard. All right. But I'll say it's the rhino one, Steve. I maybe the swan, but that giant swan just sounds too cool. So I'll just say rhino and guess.
Rhino's the fiction. Okay, yeah, Bob. Rhino.
So the first one, the deer with five horns. I've never seen like five horns as described here. And that alone makes me want to say that that's fiction. And then the giant swans. What? I mean, that's just... all of these are great candidates, but what really is freaking me out is a 25 feet at the shoulder rhino. No, fiction.
Oh, wow. Okay. Thanks, Bob. You made me feel good.
Should I correct Bob on his math?
You don't know.
Wait a second. What'd you say?
5 meters.
Closer to 20 feet, probably.
More like 16 feet, 17, not 20.
Okay. Well, wait, let me think about that again.
Still massive. I mean, that's massive creature.
5 meters is exactly
Bob, don't change.
16.4 feet.
Yeah, it's a little
feet.
Over 16 feet.
Yeah, that's almost two stories, Bob. Almost.
That's a lot better, though, than 25 was what I was thinking. All right.
Don't change. If I go down, I want to go
see,
down.
What would Steve do with a bird? Steve, I don't think he would make that up. I think he'd be like, yeah, look at that bird. I'll stay with the rhino.
How come when anyone mimics me, they sound like Urkel? I don't speak that way. All right. Kara?
I think I'm going to break from the boys, and I think it is the bird that's the fiction. Only because this is the part that doesn't sit well with me. There might have been a giant swan, and I want that to be true. And it might have been larger than a dwarf elephant. So I'm imagining a swan that's like, I don't know. I mean, how small is a dwarf elephant?
Right.
Let's
that's
say it's like the size
thinking.
Of a dog, like a large dog, or like a pony. And a swan is like even bigger than like a miniature pony, maybe. But how in the hell is a bird way more than an elephant? Birds have hollow bones. Like, I just can't imagine a bird that is like, even if it has a big, like it's taller or it's got like a massive bill or like really big wings, like birds don't weigh that much. So I don't know. Like, I would love to compare. I wish I knew how much an ostrich weighed, but I don't buy that a large swan would weigh more than an elephant. So that's the fiction to me.
Okay. And Jay.
So the first one here, extinct deer spotted. It has five horns. That's so cool.
It doesn't say it was spotted.
Sported. He sported a saber like that. I'm just skimming it here. Okay, I'm skimming. I'm trying to hurry up. Steve doesn't want me to, you know, to ruminate.
You are last, Jay. You are last. You had the whole time. Roommate.
Canine fangs and five horns. If it doesn't exist, I don't want to exist. That's my first one. Yeah. The second one, the rhino. Oh my God, this thing was huge. But I don't think it really looked like a rhino if this thing existed. It wasn't like a rhino, which has short, ridiculous legs, and then all of a sudden it's got these huge legs. It had to be something that was before a rhino that would probably kind of maybe looked a little bit like a rhino. But I could see that because it's basically a dinosaur at that point. Thank you. So the only thing that's left is the giant swan. Giant swan has to be fake. I totally agree with Kara. Birds don't get that big and that heavy. And everybody knows that the word Malta is made up.
All right.
All the people living in Malta right now.
Yeah,
like
so you all agree
fist.
With number one, so we'll start there. Hoplito merix mathii, Hoplito merix, is an extinct deer that sported saber-like upper canine fangs and five horns, including a central horn from its forehead. You guys all think that one is science. Apparently, none of you are bothered by the fact that deer, as a class, have antlers. And not horns.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Do you guys know the difference between antlers and horns?
Are horns made out of hair?
Antlers yeah, possibly. Have like fleshy material on the outside.
And antlers grow back, I think.
Do
antlers
one of them
are bone. They grow under the felt or whatever that what do you call that?
The velvet.
Yeah. And they usually fall off seasonally and grow back.
Right.
Horns are made of keratin, like your nails.
Hair.
Yeah.
Crap.
And they, as a family, deer have, like deer, elk, moose have antlers, and goats and, you know, antelope and someone else have horns. However.
Yeah. That said.
This deer had horns.
Oh,
yay.
This is science. Cool. Had five of them. Five horns. This thing is freakish. And I mean, giant fangs that like went below its lower jaw, like saber-toothed fangs.
So why would a deer need to be that badass?
Because everything was badass back then.
I know, that's the bias. Like whenever you, like ever see a cartoon of the past, like everything,
yeah,
is like saber-toothed.
Everything had saber-toothed. Yeah. And the low brow. You know, like.
Everything is brutish. But yeah, it's yeah. There's a modern deer that has the fangs, but they're way smaller than this thing. And the five horns, you know, these are usually, you know, the horns and antlers are for mating displays and competition. You
know? Horns and antlers, knees and toes, knees and toes,
knees and toes.
So yeah, very cool looking. I would love.
Yeah, I did bring up a picture of it, and wow. That thing, you know what? I would run from that deer. I'd run from that.
Does it look like a? Is it like unicorn-esque?
Yeah, well, the middle horn, it curves up, but it's still, it's in the place of a unicorn. It's exactly in the place of a unicorn horn.
It's not straight. It's curved. I'll tell
but
you
it
right
curves
now,
up.
Kara, it has the exact curve that you would think an evil horn would be impaling flesh of another creature.
Yeah, so it's like a crown of horns, because it has five horns from, you know, the front like arc from, you know, the, over the eyes and the middle of the forehead. Very
now,
cool.
Steve, how did these ever go, you know, how did these ever go extinct if they're so horny?
Yeah.
Hi-o.
Well, they didn't live for a long time.
That's a joke, Evan. Yes, yes, I know. I had the good sense to tell mine while
all
we
right,
weren't recording.
Let's go to number two.
Number two.
The largest ever confirmed land mammal was a rhino relative, Paraceratherium, standing over 5 meters, 16 feet, not 25 feet, at the shoulder, and weighing up to 4 times more than adult African elephants. So it is Bob and Evan who think that that's just too damn big. Jay and Kara, you don't buy the giant swans. I don't know why you're so bothered by a bird that wouldn't even have to be as big as an ostrich or as a moa. You guys, right?
Dwarf flightless,
really?
Tiny. Well, those moas were pretty big.
Dwarf elephants were tiny. Statue. So
but
which one of these two things is the fiction?
One of these things is not
well,
like the other.
The Paraceratherium is science.
Is it really
it
science?
Is.
Gun.
This
that's
thing
so badass.
Was massive. Mother. You just got to see like the silhouette of like a person standing next to one of these things. It is dinosaur
person.
Size. It is massive.
Yeah, right?
Now, these were herbivores.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, yes, Evan, why did they get so big? To eat the tops of trees, just like giraffes. But instead of getting the configuration, they just got big everywhere. You know, they just got, they're more slender and lanky than a rhino. They have longer legs.
Yeah, they don't look like a rhino, guys.
They look kind of rhino-ish, but if you stretched a rhino out to make it as tall as possible, but keeping it still horizontal, as opposed to the giraffe, which got its head all the way up, you know what I mean? So it just is a different evolutionary strategy in order, and it probably could stand up on its hind legs to reach the top of trees and et cetera. But just a different evolutionary approach to getting the vegetation above everything else, all the other competition, right? Eating the highest leaves.
Is it horny?
It just, no horns, no horns.
No horny.
No horns, yeah. But God, you look at that thing, you're like, damn, that is a monster. That was huge, you know? You guys have all stood next to elephants, right? Elephants are massive beasts. These things just dwarfed an African elephant. And speaking of dwarf elephants, so during the Pleistocene period of Malta, there lived giant swans that were larger and heavier than the local dwarf elephants. That is the fiction, but there's only two words in that sentence that make it the fiction.
What?
And Kara, you hit upon it. And those two words are, and heavier. They were taller than the dwarf elephants of the time.
Holy crap, they were taller? They were it wasn't taller. Just their wingspan?
It's not that much, no, taller. Because then, you know, swans are pretty tall to begin with. And these
not
were,
taller than elephants.
Not elephants, but these were dwarf elephants. So but these were giant swans, Cygnus falconeri. Ooh. And it was both Malta and Sicily is where they were found. So they stood over like 6 feet tall, right? So you think about that, like a goose, a giant goose that's 6 feet. It's not that big. It's not as big as an ostrich, right? But yeah, the dwarf elephants were tiny. They were small, less than 6 feet at the shoulder. But they were heavier. They were still beefier. A goose is still a goose. So I threw in the and heavier to make it the fiction. And you hit upon that. That's true.
Yay. Because birds have hollow bones.
Yeah, but yeah, the hollow bones, interestingly, so you ask people, why do birds have hollow bones?
Because they have to fly. For flight. And, if you're not flying, you don't need it.
But why? Why? Well, how does being hollow make them help?
I thought it made them lighter.
So that's the common myth. But I thought that too. Crap. Until I learned what was actually true. It turns out.
Stronger?
Nope.
Faster?
Well, the birds do have light, strong bones, but so do a lot of species. But that's not really why they have the air pockets in the bones. The air pockets exchange oxygen. They exchange oxygen. Because when they need massive oxygen infusion when they're flying. They just need to power their muscles.
Metabolic.
So it's really for metabolic, yeah.
Wow.
All right, so let's see. The dwarf Sicilian elephant, only 5 feet long, it says.
Cute. It was like my size.
Yeah, does it say how high it was at the shoulder? You know, it's probably similar at the, looking at it, 4 or 5 feet at the shoulder. So, yeah, so the goose was taller. So imagine living on an island where the geese are bigger than your freaking elephants. So this, you guys know about island dwarfism, right? Yeah. The phenomenon of island dwarfism. So this is a manifestation of that. But island dwarfism actually is more complicated. It's not just that everything gets smaller. It's usually that small things get bigger and big things get smaller. But also there's just weirdly sized things on islands. So
yeah, things just kind of keep going on islands, which is weird. Like things, I guess you're right. Big things get smaller and small things get bigger. That's so strange.
Yeah,
there's also just weirdness that has like runaway evolution on islands.
Yeah, because of isolation. Yeah, the extreme isolation, which is great. So yeah, I'm just scratching the surface, man. There were so many weird extinct mammals. You know, this is definitely going to be a future category as well. But man,
I was hoping you were going to do the ichthyosaurus. No, sorry, not the ichthyosaurus. The Spinosaurus. There's like big news this week that Spinosaurus swims.
I know. That's the other news. I saw that as well, but that was too out there because you saw it. So Spinosaurus is the biggest carnivore, land carnivore ever, right? It was the biggest carnivorous dinosaur. And the question for a long time has been, was it aquatic or not? And now we have new evidence that it was indeed aquatic.
Yeah, and that would make it the only aquatic dinosaur, because when we think of most of the things that swam, right, the only one, most of the things that swam in the ocean at the time were not dinosaurs, they were reptiles, swimming
other
reptiles. Like Mosasaur, Ichthyosaur, all of those are not actually dinosaurs.
They were non-dinosaur reptiles, that's correct. Say like pterodactyloids, they were
they're
non-dinosaur group of reptiles, yeah.
Flying reptiles, yeah.
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 Cool. Oh, God. I'd love to go to a zoo of all these creatures, you know?
Oh, my gosh. Me too. There's like this movie about that. You could go.
Yeah. If you get to like Jurassic Park, of course, would be awesome. But Pleistocene Park would be awesome.
Pleistocene Park.
No, it would. Totally awesome.
It would be scary.
Kara, what is your favorite extinct mammal?
Oh, gosh. I'd have to really think about that. I mean, I spent some time in the tar pits here, and they have a lot of really cool extinct mammals. It might be this. Is it the saber-toothed cat?
Yeah.
Is what it's actually called. They're really badass. Not the, like, quote-unquote saber-toothed tiger, but the saber-toothed cat.
Mm-hmm.
And they're
I like colicotheres.
I don't know.
Just because they're so bizarre looking. They're like Dr. Seuss animals. You know, they just have these really long front legs and short hind legs.
But ooh, that deer, that's creepy. That thing looks scary.
Yeah, but the deer is now on my top five list.
I might have to. Yeah, my answer was lame. I got to think about it more. Because it's like, I just don't think much about extinct mammals, but they have a lot of them at the tar pits and they're really cool. Or they have one really big one. There's the difference between like the woolly mammoth and then the other one. What's the other one that's like? Yeah, the mastodon. Mastodons are pretty badass too.
Yeah.
Woolly mammoths are, I think, they're like twice as big as African elephants. They were huge too, but these things are twice as big as them. There's also, now I had to throw in the word confirmed, because when I was doing my background research on this, there is another contender which might eke out the Paraceratherium as the biggest mammal, but we only have like teeth and stuff. We don't have enough bones to confirm how big it was. But, you know, extrapolating from the bones we do have, it could have been bigger than
that
animal. There's an ancient Asian elephant called Paleoloxodon namidicus, may have been bigger, but we don't have enough of the skeleton to know for sure. It says they have a thigh bone, which is big as a fully grown man.
What's the thigh bone connected to?
You beat me to it.
Right. This ancient Asian elephant may edge it out at some point. It's definitely close if it's not bigger, but we don't have enough to confirm it. But the Paraceratherium, we have more specimens of enough to confirm how big it was. So I did also saw, I used sort of the average estimates of its height and weight. I saw different numbers quoted in different references, but that's close enough. All right. Good job, Jay and Kara.
Thank you.
That was a challenging one.
Mm. It was.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
Naturopaths want to be able to do everything an MD wants to do, but they also want to practice, essentially, witchcraft. Elegantly spoken by Britt Marie Hermes.
Yep.
Friend of the show, former naturopath, and perhaps its most outspoken critic these days.
Yep. Yeah, it's witchcraft. It's so, like, homeopathy is totally witchcraft. It's completely witchcraft.
There is nothing cromulent about it.
Yeah.
Steve, you know what you said about naturopathy and naturopaths? In essence, in essence, they practice a hodgepodge of nonsense. The only things that these treatments seem to have in common is that they are not science-based.
Yeah.
That's the qualifier.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
You got it, man.
Thanks, sure,
man.
Zach.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.